at session number 31558, reel 10.
So then we went just after that. The regiment was replenished and the lorries came up throwing tins of petrol and boxes of ammunition to all the tanks as quickly as they could, and they got away, and I was rather pleased. I got three letters from Anne, and so I was very bucked at that, maybe very happy. And we got some rather nice food and it replenished very, very quickly. And after that, we had, I think, one more night of this, and then the rain set in so badly that the whole thing came to a stalemate, and we were pulled right back. Outside Ifs, for one night, there was a whole lot of white rabbits had escaped, and one made a burrow down an unexploded shell hole. So we kept a watch on the rabbit whenever he went down the shell hole. Everybody went into the tank in case it exploded, and if not, we could get out and brew up tea or something like that, which is what people wanted to do. And there was the usual nasty smells as well, but there's just a few nice things, and this rabbit was one of them. And there was a very sad thing in the village of Ifs, on the hedge below it. There was inside the house that we used as took shelter in. We had a mess there. We had supper one or two evenings while we were there in this, and then went back to the tanks. And there was a wedding photograph badly torn. It said to my dearest husband and other things like that. And outside was his grave in the ditch. Obviously him. There was one person we found whose tin hat had a hole in it, and his rifle was stuck in the ground to mark it for later on. That was outside Jerusalem's. And yes, and the tin hat had a neat hole on the inside and splayed out on the outside, so he must have been shot by a German lying in the ditch as he was creeping along it, almost from underneath, before he saw him. Anyway, after that, we were pulled right back to reform at Carpique, at the aerodrome, and we went through Caen on the way, and it seemed absolutely devastated. I remember we had to go rather fast because the tanks in front were going fast, and mine slid sideways over the cobbles, and while I was looking at the cathedral, and we were going round the cathedral, that was the only part that didn't seem to be so badly damaged. And also there was a big building which had turned into a hospital beside it. I think it was a cathedral school or something like that. It had red crosses on the roof, and that wasn't too badly damaged. But otherwise, the shelling that we'd done and the bombing of Caen, it had absolutely flattened the town. Not to the extent of Villers-Bocage, but I think about 75% of the, nearly all the centre of the town had been damaged. When we got through that to Carpique, we were on the edge of the aerodrome, and there had been a lot of very heavy fighting because somebody went to dig a latrine for himself, and he dug up he got something on the end of it, and he levered it up, and it was a head with a tin hat on it, and somebody else in B squadron, so they were all close, started to dig, and he had a human arm on his spade. So it was really not very nice after that. We were very careful to dig if we wanted to dig a hole for a slit trench, to dig it in undamaged soil. And it was there that this amalgamation took place of the 3rd and 4th CLY. And so they said to me, do you want to go back? So I said, no, no, I'll stay with the joint regiment. Well, they said, I think probably we've got surplus officers now, and so you better go back because you've got a leg iron on, everybody else is reasonably fit. And so the MO, Captain McNeil, who's a very good friend of mine, said, if you go, I'll give you documents so you can go back into Dakota. And so I spent the night in a hospital, and the sister of the hospital said, I got to take your pistol and your weapons. And I said, no, I can't do that. She said, well, if the Germans come and find you in a hospital, even a field hospital, you have to give them up. So in the morning I asked the MO and he gave them to me, because I said, if the Germans were as close as that, I would be gone. He wouldn't have me in this hospital because I wouldn't want to be taken prisoner. And I had no success, but anyway, the next day I went into Dakota plus all my own weapons and things, and I did hand them over when we got back to England. But next to me was an infantryman of 79th, I think, armored 79th, not armored, 50 div, the infantry division we were with. I think I said 79th before, I meant 50th armored. If I said 79th, because they were Hobart's division of Fannies and flame-firing Cromwells, Churchills and things like that. And this fellow said, got shot in the foot, and he said, I was cleaning my rifle, it went off, it was a genuine accident, I didn't shoot myself in the foot. And I was very sorry for him, because I didn't believe a word he said. So I pretended, I said, of course not, I know you didn't, obviously, if you say you didn't. And so he was sort of sitting on the floor in the back of this Dakota with me, and I was trying to cheer him up and saying, well, at least you'll be out of action for a while. And then we got to Swindon and we were, it landed and we were taken out, and that's really the end of my story. Afterwards I was posted to a training regiment. And by that time, by end of November, or middle of November, it was pretty nearly the end of the war, we could think. There hadn't been the Battle of the Bulge, but it looked as though things were going on. Letters I got from the regiment said they were going steadily through Holland, and it was very dreary and dull and cold, but that was all. And so I went to the War Office, and as I always did, I wanted something. And I said, I volunteered into the army, can I volunteer out now? I want to go to Cambridge quickly and get my degree because I'm married. And then I want to get back and help win the peace. So they said, yes, good idea. And so they said, you can. And I, of course, I had to go back for a while until the orders came through, and I was given a made an honorary captain, and a very nice letter from the War Office. And the ATS driver took me to my parents-in-law house, which wasn't all that far away from being at, outside, it was Chinna, outside High Wycombe, not just beyond High Wycombe. And so I then had the hardest mental time of my life trying to learn up the things I'd forgotten completely. And that's really the end of the story. I got back to Anne, and then we had our baby who was on the way, and then we went back to Cambridge.
When was it then that you returned to Cambridge?
At the beginning of 1945.
You mentioned that the constant firing in Normandy. What sort of effect on the morale and your mental state did that have?
That's a difficult question. I don't think it had all that effect. We got very shaky, I know that. I still don't like fireworks very much, and I think it's due to that. We had to be so quick. But I don't think it really upset morale. What upset morale is really being joined as 3rd SEAL by 3rd, 4th SEAL by and being taken out of 7th Armored Division to their independent brigade. That was made people very sad, I think.
Did the relative lack of effectiveness of your tanks against the Tigers, especially and the Panzers, have an effect on the morale? And
that did very much, yes. That was the worst thing. That's what they worried about in England before we went. And we were told you weren't getting out of the tanks anyway. But it wasn't the thinness of the tank that worried me. It was this stupid fault of having a turret which, when you traverse more than about 45 degrees, the driver couldn't bail out. Or in the case of Cromwell, where we had a driver and the co-driver was operational with a machine gun, he couldn't have bailed out if it had traversed over his head. The flaps wouldn't have opened. And it wasn't they could theoretically climb up through the turret, but it took so long that if a tank were hit, the ammunition would have been exploded by that time. And it was that I found most worrying, just remembering I mustn't traverse the turret. Well, in those narrow lanes, you had to do it sometimes. And I didn't like doing that. In the desert, it was much easier. You could always face your crusader at the enemy, or nearly always. It was only turning around or something like that was dangerous. But this constant firing in itself, I don't think was too bad. Just made us jumpy. For me, it made me very jumpy. But beyond that, I just was quicker at getting under the tank when I heard something coming. It was these supersonic things that were, you had a shell coming, you could hear it, you usually have time to throw yourself down. And if you're throwing yourself down, then you didn't feel frightened because you're so busy throwing. One time I did that and a wasp got inside my shirt and stung me. And I barely noticed it, and I remembered afterwards that I'd been stung by a wasp. I felt it faintly during the day, but never again did I think of it.
We were able to have contact with you mentioned the RAF air support. Was there any contact with the aircraft?
On a regimental level, it was. The colonel's tank did have a rear link operator. His name was Harry Ramsbottom. He was one of the ones I had to write to, and I wrote to his wife, because he just joined the regiment in time. He'd been wounded, I think, in Sicily, or in Italy, rather. And I wrote and said that I thought he was dead, but I hadn't seen anybody bail out. But actually, they had bailed out of the Sherman on the Cromwell, rather, that he was in. He was a rear link, and in his hull position. He had managed to bail out. He'd been very badly burnt while he was doing it. And he was sent to a hospital in Normandy by the Germans. And when they do after Falaise Gap, the whole hospital was taken over, and he was rescued and came back to England alive. So he was all right.
What was your opinion of the strategy in Normandy as a whole?
Well, I thought that if we'd known that, obviously the higher command didn't know what the country was going to be like. If they had, they wouldn't have done it quite like theirs. We wouldn't have been into these tiny little Bocage fields, which were absolute death traps for Cromwell tanks, and they were pretty well for Shermans as well. We didn't have a single decent tank that could match for the Panther or a Tiger, or even for that four Mark IV Special, because the Mark IV Special had thinner armour than the Cromwell, but it was sloping, so they weren't all that easy to knock out, although they were the standard weapon of the Panzerlehr and the first SS Panzer and the other one in the division, the Hitler Youth one.
Would there have been any question of your staying on in the army when you returned?
Not by that stage. No. What I realised is that it wasn't for me. I didn't know there wouldn't be. I still sort of vaguely thought of it, but after I was wounded, I didn't think I'd be much of a career. But up till then, I thought quite well. I'd rather assumed I couldn't think farther ahead than that. It was only at the latter date that I realised it wouldn't be possible, and I didn't want to after I got married. But before then, I quite liked it. But I don't think I would have done, because being short-sighted, I've always been bad at ball games, and most sports involve ball games. The only thing I did anything success at was in 1940, in the one term that I was up there. I was in Pembroke's second boat, and although we got bumped three times and went down, bumped every night, at least I was in the second boat. And if we'd had a quicker start, we'd have done quite well. Our timing was good, but we were very heavy. I think the lightest person weighed about 12 stone, which is very heavy for boat crew, and we didn't really get off the mark quick enough. We couldn't do it. Anyhow, I was better at rowing than anything else, where I didn't have to look and have a good sight.
What do you remember of VE Day?
Well, I was in Cambridge then, VE Day, and we knew it was coming by that time pretty well. We'd seen heard on the radio all kinds of things about concentration camps, and the first one, the ones that the British had relieved anyway, and we saw it on the news, photographs, government British news reels of the way that they treated the Germans, so we weren't at all sorry about that time. We were sorry about the Corps offensive having been such a failure, because when the time came, the 1st and 2nd North Hants Yeomanry, and I think that the tanks that I saw in Birmingham were 1st North Hants Yeomanry, the ones that the 2nd North Hants Yeomanry didn't get into action until after that, when they drove the night drive and they got right through everything and just had to hold the position they were in, and they were the ones that knocked out with their Cromwells, with our one anti-tank gun that was worked. They knocked out Wittmann, and he was killed then. So that was the end of his career, which I was not sorry to hear about, actually.
What was the atmosphere like in Cambridge at the end of the war?
Well, there were an awful lot of Americans there who hadn't been in it yet and thought they were going to be in it, and they made a lot of fun and games about it, you know, and so on, but I don't think we stayed at home and got on with things. What was the date? It was May, wasn't it?
For VE Day?
Yes. It was quite early. It was still in term time, and I was far too busy with trying to relearn things, and Anne got a physiotherapy job as well for somebody else who she knew, who was a physiotherapist, and We were both very busy, and it was rather sort of undergraduate type of thing. And by that time, there was two groups. There were the people who just up and the people who were who really came up in 1946 was when the majority of the people got demobbed. And 45 was pretty quiet, really, until the Michaelmas term began. And well, it was obviously coming, so I wasn't awfully moved by it.
What was it you were reading at Cambridge?
I was reading part one, Tripos, Natural Sciences Tripos, but I was specialised in zoology for part two, and then I did a PhD in entomology.
What was it then that led you towards the zoological field?
Well, I'd always been interested in water beetles and things like that, and newts, and we had a pond in the garden, and I'd always liked them, and I liked watching them. And so when I got to Cambridge, then I learnt about other things as well, other animals. And I did some little minor research, things that had never been done while I was an undergraduate. Because they, in the demonstration, for example, on centipedes, talking about Lithobius, the ones about an inch and a half long with 17 pairs of legs. And it said the observations in the Cambridge Natural History had been made by somebody called Sinclair in the beginning of this century, but not very late in this. And he said that the centipede does everything by feeling. And later on in the same article, the same chapter of the book, he said, when it sees the eggs of another centipede, it rushes and eats them. So he said, how could it see the eggs if it did all its work by feeling? So I tried cutting off antennae and then seeing if the centipedes could find food. And I very soon found that they couldn't catch a fly that I put in there for them unless they actually touched it with their heads, if their antennae had gone. If they had their antennae, then they could do it perfectly well. With one antenna, they waved it about in front. So that was the first thing it was the second.
How did you find the post-war atmosphere in Britain towards the end of the decade in the 40s?
Oh, by that time, it was the shortage of housing that was worrying to people who were married. That was quite a number of the ones who were demobbed after V-Day. There were all sorts of things. You could buy a mobile, a portable home if you bought land. We thought about this. But how long they had to do it? They were built of cedar, and you put them up, and they were supposed to last for 10 years. But then when I came to do a PhD, it was obvious that we had to buy something. My parents gave me the money to buy a house, with what I'd saved and so on, we could pay the, what was it, 8,000 or 5,000, something like that, sum to buy a house. And then I think it was 8,000 actually, and we had about 10,000 saved up. Anne had some money her grandfather had left her, and we bought a Marco refrigerator, and we did this house up, and that was in 1950. But just before that, I went on a Cambridge Iceland exhibition. I really wanted to go to the tropics, but there wasn't an exhibition there. And by that time, we were living in digs in Panton Street. And I went to Scott Polar Research Institute. It was the only thing I could imagine could get me out of England to see something more of the world. And they said, well as Bob Menges is taking a expedition to Iceland in June and July, or July and August, I forget which. And if anything falls through, you could be the reserve for that. So Bob said, that's fine. And then luckily for me, somebody got appendicitis and couldn't come. And so I was able to go on that. And there were four of us. Bob Menges had been in the Navy, in a submarine upstart. He'd got a DSC for... They came up inside Marseilles Harbour, and they shot up a railway train. I always thought how fun it would be to shoot up an engine of an enemy train. Anyway, they did this, and then they got they submerged and came out and got out. And the Germans said it wasn't possible to get through the anti-submarine booms and nets and things. They must have been done by sabotage. And so they shot 20 French hostages. And when they heard about this, they weren't at all pleased what they'd done, of course. It wasn't worth it. And then there was Denny Brock, who'd been in the Marines, because he had an uncle who was an admiral. So he had to go into the Marines. And he was in the Far East, and he was on a battleship. And he saw quite a bit of action, I think, one way or another, towards the Japanese. And then John Mercer had been in the Merchant Navy, so he'd seen it. So we all had different views on what it was like. It was a very interesting trip. We got on well together.
What was the object of the expedition?
Well, Bob wanted to measure how the ice flows in the valleys at the edge of the ice cap, how the ice compacted, and they could tell by doing samples and taking out cores and so on, and digging down what it was like. And it turned out it was simpler to dig out a cave way into the ice, and then you could crawl down this, or you could even stooping, you could walk down it, and you could brew up some pemmican, which we were living on those days, and do these measurements. They were all glaciologists. I was the only biologist, so I was trying to collect spiders and harvest spiders and any mites, water mites, things like that. And so I collected a few. That was got me rather interested in water mites. And then later on, my last term at Cambridge I'd already done something on water mites, but I found that when I put them in my aquarium tank, the guppy fishes that were in there would bite them and spit them out, and sticklebacks did the same, so I thought they must be distasteful being scarlet. And so I was rather pleased with this, and I put a demonstration to the Cambridge Natural History Society showing these mites swimming about, and I think that impressed Wigglesworth. He took me on to be a research student for him. But then I discovered that Elton had done the same experiment in 1923 or something and got the same result. But his was published in the Zoological Society, and mine was published in Annals and Magazine of Natural History, I think.
How was it then that you later came to go to Sudan?
Well, I remembered what the desert was like, and by that time I was getting interested in temperatures under rocks and holes and things like that. And I thought, I went on an expedition to southern Tunisia in 1954, and I found there that the temperature down a scorpion hole was very delayed. The hottest part of the day of the temperature was at 6 p.m. or 3 p.m., whereas in the desert, it was outside, it was at noon. And so I was comparing these temperatures and things.